Political report. I don't think this has been a week packed full of news. Hence, when it came to deciding what picture to illustrate the political report with in this week's Weekly Worker, I sort of plumped for Ukraine on the basis I couldn't really think of anything else. So I'm sort of obliged to begin with Ukraine. And quite frankly, I'm in a position of, well, the news is that sort of ish, that there's no news. I don't know what the weather forecast is, and I'm not being facetious, in Ukraine is at the moment, but we are certainly on the cusp or at the beginning, of the rainy season in Ukraine. And what that means in Ukraine is mud. And any general will tell you that that's a killer. That soldiers would rather fight in midwinter when the ground is solid than when it's mud. And of course, if you look along the front line in Ukraine, of course, it's not neatly supplied with roads. Quite the opposite. What you'll be going over is unsurfaced tracts. And what happens to your trucks is they sink deep, deep into mud. Your infantry, get literally bogged down in mud, and even tanks have difficulty in the mud season. Why does this matter? Well, it matters because Ukraine's spring offensive, well, I'll call it the summer offensive because it really began just at the end of spring, has, in spite of all the propaganda that is being pumped out by the BBC and almost every other media, mainstream media channel or source, the reality is that what we're dealing with is maybe a village here, a mile there. But nothing else. I have to say that I was very skeptical at the beginning of the offensive. As soon as I looked at these famous, I think now, pictures, by the FT and the BBC showing what Russia had been doing all through winter, i.e. digging, digging, digging. The idea of Ukraine equipped with its new Leopard tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles punching through these fortifications and getting all the way to the Azov Sea. I could have been wrong, but personally, I was utterly unconvinced. And my own take on it, for what it's worth, and I can't say this in any definitive way, is that Ukraine was sort of obliged to stage an offensive. And it certainly seems that the training, the advice that's being dished out by top NATO officials, seemingly, when they put it into practice, on the ground in Ukraine, proved to be disastrous. In other words, the idea of selecting your particular point, in terms of these fortifications and using your new armor and concentrating your newly trained forces in order to break through, it basically led to slaughter. It led to the destruction of this highly prized, highly expensive equipment. Not that that was widely reported in the West, but it was sort of unavoidable because Russia was simply taking, drone pictures of wrecked Leopards, wrecked Bradley fighting vehicles. And we discovered, I think relatively recently, that in order to break through, which they have a first line and purportedly a second line in the south, what they've been forced to resort to is not armor, but individual groups of sappers going in to this no man's land and basically blowing up mines, which are incredibly tightly packed. And yeah, they've managed to do that. I create a channel where you can push your forces. They've managed to get to the first line. They've managed to penetrate the first line, and as I said, there are reports of a second line. But what I've just been reading is, of course, there is a third line, and meanwhile, of course, what we have is Russian artillery, and one presumes drones and other such military equipment raining in shells. And so my understanding is, for example, in the area that Ukraine has captured, in the language of the BBC, that it's liberated, you cannot move at daytime, and you only move at night in an armored vehicle. Well, in other words, what we have is the inability of Ukraine, having penetrated two lines of defense, to concentrate its forces in order to drive south. They are cowering as I'm speaking. So I was just reading a short time before this meeting started, the boast, which is such a giveaway to me, a boast that Ukraine, having captured the first line of defense, which is apparently the deepest, and it involves tunnels, and you can go down one trench and underground, and you can pop up somewhere else. They are sheltering in the first line of defense. It's well made, but that's precisely the message, that this much vaunted offensive has got them to the first line of defense, of where they are digging themselves in, keeping their heads down, because there's so much firepower coming in against them. And again, I don't know whether the figures are accurate, but they're chilling enough for me to take them as at least something I would confidently quote, because they are so high. That in order to have done that, in order to have penetrated the first line and maybe a second line, and then to hanker down, it's so far, according to the BBC, cost Ukraine 70,000 dead. We're not talking about casualties, so we're not just talking about people injured, we're talking about dead, which is an enormous number. I'm not quite equating it to World War II, no, excuse me, World War I, the Western Front and all the rest of it. Nevertheless, it's got that sort of feeling to it. But of course, with the addition of drone and missile warfare, and everywhere else you look in terms of military, the military front, so Bakhmut, for example, we're still being told, again, in the language of celebration, that Ukraine has gained two villages in the environs of Bakhmut. If you read a little bit more carefully, or you read the more thoughtful observers, though, I don't know whether they've captured these villages or whether the Russian forces have abandoned them. Because what I read is that these villages are low-lying and therefore easy targets when it comes to artillery fire. So maybe it's not Ukraine making an advance, more Ukraine falling into a trap where they're going to be subject to literally deadly bombardment. But the long and the short of it is, as far as I can see it, is that this offensive was something that Zelensky and his advisors, those running the war, felt obliged to conduct. Maybe because of domestic opinion, maybe because of international opinion, i.e., NATO opinion, or a combination of both. I would suspect myself a combination of both. Either way, if you get rid of the hype, what we're dealing with is an offensive that has produced nothing of any value whatsoever. And as I said, we are now either in or on the cusp of the rainy season, when any serious advance simply becomes impossible. Indeed, it becomes problematic actually supplying your frontline positions anyway. So they still have to be supplied with artillery shells. They still have to be supplied with fuel. They still have to be supplied with food. And that is incredibly difficult once the rains start. So, where I was, when I was in the dark on this, I could sort of go along, with the rantings and ravings of Prizetskin and the Wagner group, that the Russian high command were a bunch of cowards and send them here, with a Kalashnikov and see what it's like and all the rest of it. But the reality is, the high command of the Russian army knew what they were doing. And they'd rejected the idea of going on the offensive. They'd retreated already to defense lines like big rivers, high ground. So the explanation for the stunning success of the last Ukrainian offensive had less to do with the military prowess of Ukraine, it seems now, and more with the high command on the Russian side saying, look, we're going to hold what we've got. And areas that are too vulnerable, we're simply going to give up. Now, maybe sometimes that was done with a nod and a wink with Ukrainian forces. I don't know. Either way, that's what they've done. And of course, what they've then done is dig, 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 and plant, 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 minefields, dragon's teeth, putting in place defended artillery positions, and all the rest of it, with the result that we've seen throughout the summer. And basically, the result is no change, and any change that has been achieved at horrendous human cost. Okay, so in other words, what the Russian army is engaged in is a passive strategy, and that clearly has worked over the summer. Okay, the only other thing to add, of course, again, that this gets the publicity, at least from the news sources that I've looked at, i.e. mainstream news sources, and that is missiles hitting Ukraine, various attacks on no, excuse me, Crimea, and various other facilities, associated with the Russian Navy attacks on Russian submarines and other shipping. I have to say that in military terms, that is pretty irrelevant. It makes great headlines, having a plume of smoke and reports of a Russian ship being hit. What they don't tend to report is how many missiles were shot down, how expensive those missiles were. And I'm still left with a so what? Russia still is in a position where it can blockade Ukraine, in terms of the Black Sea, either with mines or ships or surface ships or submarines. Ukraine isn't just about to invade Crimea via the sea. It hasn't got a navy to speak of, and attacks on Russia, the Russian Federation itself. While no doubt a nuisance and a morale boost, it doesn't decide the war. These are pinpricks. So it has the equivalent value, I suppose, of Hitler's decision to shift from attacking the RAF, the Royal Air Force in World War II, in its bases, its fighter command in particular, to shifting to night bombing over London. And I know London has suffered. My mum was in London at the time. My dad was far safer out there in India than my mum was in London. Nonetheless, British industry, aligned with the United States, was turning out enough tanks, enough ships, enough guns, enough shells to overcome easily any damage that German bombing was doing. And the same applied the other way round, actually, until the very end, in spite of Bomber Command hammering German cities, German arms production still went up year by year. And I think it was only at the very end of World War II did that start to level off and they went into a problem. So far from this myth that the world was supplied with, fed with at the end of World War I, that air power was now supreme, that civilians would surrender with the first bombing, this isn't true. And so my own take on it is that Zelensky in reality has been reduced to using British and French missiles, drones against Moscow, and all the rest of it, because he's got nothing to report when it comes to the front line except death and failure. So that's my thoughts on Ukraine. At least at the moment. I could be completely wrong. And next week I'll have to eat humble pie because there you are. You've got Ukrainian troops paddling in the Azov Sea, but I doubt it. Okay, I wanted just to turn now to Donald Trump. Not so much his legal difficulties, but we do need to mention them, in terms of his boasts about property, his deals, the various legal cases that will be happening next year in the campaigning year. But I just wanted to mention, I didn't take out time to watch it. I did it last time round when we had the whole list of Republican candidates. I watched the first debate because I was just stunned. That one Donald Trump was standing. And I was stunned by the fact that they allowed him to win through. And by them, who do I mean? The Republican establishment. It was a bit like my experience with Jeremy Corbyn. I didn't think that he would get through to the leadership contest. He got through literally in the last few minutes of the last hour. But as soon as I saw him on a BBC debate with the rather plastic opponents that he had against him, I was convinced, even though this debate was in front, this was a BBC debate, even if it was in front of former Labour voters, I just went, Jesus Christ, Jeremy Corbyn is going to win it. And I had the same experience really with Trump. I've never watched The Apprentice or whatever other bloody TV programs he's been in. But against the others, he was different. Either way, what he's doing is showing, I would have thought, a calculated, well-calculated contempt for the his opponents in the Republican Party. And so I haven't watched it. But I've just read the press report. So here we have the second round of Republican debates. This one is in, I think, the R Ronald Reagan Library in California. And anyway, they have the debate, and apparently, according to the pundits or the the people who go out there and interview the how should I put it, the Republican voters afterwards, here's a representative sample. Apparently, according to them, it was Ron DeSantis what won it. And then I look and go, okay, so what's remarkable is at the same time they produce an opinion poll of, I presume, Republican voters, it can't be anything else, can it? Where's, even though he won it, his popularity rating amongst Republican voters, and we're talking about Republicans who will actually vote in primaries, goes down from 14% to 11%. So the winner in this Californian debate sees their popularity ratings go down. Amazing. Meanwhile, we have Donald Trump not participating, showing his utter contempt for these people. He stands on 56%. At least that's the figures that I read. And we've had, I don't know, I know it's been dismissed as a freak, but it, you know, let's mention it. We've also had an opinion poll that, unlike the previous weeks that I've been reporting, instead of Joe Biden and Donald Trump being neck and neck, we actually have Donald Trump in one poll 10% ahead of Joe Biden. Other polls I've looked at have it 45, 42. Either way, isn't it remarkable that, not only having lost the last presidential election and then denied it and staged an attempted coup and having all sorts of legal challenges that could see him conceivably in prison, he's not only running neck and neck with Joe Biden, but at least where we sit at the present, it's conceivable that Donald Trump could actually win it. And I thought I'd just sort of segue into an associated but different story now, and I'll come back to what that means next, or next but one. I just thought it was worthwhile mentioning the retirement of Mark Milley. I don't know whether you now call him former chief of staff. I think that would be the correct title. He stepped down. And what was notable is his speech. This is in front of presidents, vice presidents, his replacement, all sorts of top brass and all the rest of it. Anyway, I just wanted to bring this bit of his speech to your attention. "We don't take an oath to a king or queen." British comrades, note that Americans are Republican. They're not jealous of the fact that we've got Prince Charles as king now. Anyway, he carries on. "Or a tyrant," which is a good old American term, isn't it, for George III. "Or a dictator, or a wannabe dictator." Now, most reporters, observers take wannabe dictator as a reference to Donald J. Trump. He was a wannabe dictator. And of course, note that it was Mark Milley that, in the middle of the January the 6th attempted coup, turns round to his guys and says, "Don't follow the orders of the fascists, only follow my orders. Have you got that?" Why? Because he was telling them to disobey the commander in chief. Now, the reason why I raise this isn't just because, well, that was an episode that's now over, now he's retired, but just note this: that if we look at the new chief of staff, in my, I don't know enough about him to comment, but my guess would be he comes from exactly the same place. His nickname is CQ, and his surname is Brown. CQ is because I think it's some sort of Air Force tag. I think it's got to do with the fact that he ejected from a F-16. I'm not going to display my ignorance about military terms any further, other than to say I think it's got something to do with that. But also worth noting is he's black, and that's the second black chief of staff in the United States, of course. And the reason I raise it is precisely because there is at least a possibility of Donald Trump, a would-be dictator, getting elected in the next presidential election And I raised it at the time of January the 6th, that, if Donald Trump had managed to persuade or intimidate the Vice President Pence not to recognize various Democrat electors, and we're talking about the Electoral College, at least in my guess, is that Miley and others would have done something about it. And that wouldn't have been passive, don't obey their orders. It would have been something positive, I obey my orders. So I raise this simply because, if Donald Trump, and it still is a big if, I admit, but it's not fantasy land, if he was elected, I think that, the constitutional crisis, the ripple of January the 6th will be, how should you put it, will look like a molehill compared with an actual election of Donald Trump. I mean, will we get the tables completely turned, for example, and Joe Biden, presuming that he's the candidate, announce that he doesn't accept the election? I haven't got a clue. But we need at least to consider these questions, that the United States is at the moment clearly not a bastion of stability in an unstable world. It's an unstable politics in the midst of an unstable world. And indeed, all we need to do is think about the last item in the political report, i.e. Ukraine. What the hell would happen in Ukraine when you get a president, if you get a president that thinks he can solve it all in one day, who's expressed skepticism about the Ukrainian war? Again, I'm just shrugging my shoulders, and I do not know. And that is the point. I don't think anyone actually knows. Okay, so I just wanted to finish the Miley story with how should I put it, a footnote that apparently in the midst, this is how this has come out since, in the midst of January the 6th, purportedly Miley rang up the Chinese, I think, Minister of Defense, or maybe his equivalent in China, i.e. the Chief of Staff. I'm not sure. Either way, the message that was conveyed is, don't worry, America is still America. We're going to handle all of this, and don't worry, the missiles aren't just about to be launched. We're not going to do anything crazy. We're going to handle it all. And what the story is, of course, is partially that, but crucially, Donald Trump's response to it, of where he said, look, in previous times, that would have meant, and this presumably was on X, or what used to be called Twitter, this would have meant death, in very Trumpian terms, all done in uppercase. Mike Miley would have been executed. And I think that isn't, I think that is testimony to the instability that exists in the United States, and the potential extreme instability that exists in the United States. Okay, moving on. I will get back to Trump, but it will actually not be in the next one. It'll be the next one after next. Okay, meanwhile, we have the Conservative Party conference up in Manchester. What a wonderful choice to organize your conference when, in interview after interview, the Prime Minister cannot answer the simple question, and that is, are you giving the go-ahead? Are you keeping on with High Speed 2 that originally was designed to go all the way up to Leeds, but also to Manchester? He can't answer that one. He can't answer whether it will go to the heart of London, if we count Euston as being in the heart of London. So he's chosen Manchester very well, where previously, Tory prime ministers have said, we're going to go up to Manchester because we can win voters up here. in traditional Labour heartlands, you know, we're going to build this high speed rail. The Northern powerhouse and other such rhetoric comes to mind. Now we have Rishi Sunak, who can't give a straight answer to a straight question. And indeed, Britain's purportedly leading sophologist, John Curtis, I think he's of Edinburgh University, could be Glasgow, but I think it's Edinburgh. He describes the Manchester conference as being the Manchester wake, because the Tories are so divided and are looking like they're facing a massive defeat. It's as simple as that. So we have a big row dividing the Tory party at the moment over taxes. Apparently, British people at the moment, British taxpayers, are paying taxes really at the level of wartime, you know, World War II, we're talking about. And of course, the Tories have always prided themselves on being a low tax, tax-cutting party. And yet, in spite of the Tories being in office for 13 years or whatever the bloody figure happens to be, here you are. And of course, what's happened is with inflation is, yes, in some industries with some jobs, wages have just about managed to keep up with inflation, but that's meant whole rafts of workers have entered into higher tax bands. And so although they've gained, you know, in terms of what used to be called the pay packet, they've lost out to the governments. So the tax take on these people has actually gone up. And that's true for people on the average wage, depending on how you do your average. So we can take it as the medium wage or the average wage with someone on a million. Either way, people on an average wage have suddenly find themselves paying, you know, wedge loads of more in terms of taxes. Okay. So meanwhile, although there's some shifting in opinion polls, the general picture for the Tories is extraordinarily gloomy. So depending on which poll you look at, they're either 18 points behind the Labour Party, or good God, we're going forward, they're 16 points behind the Tories. Things don't look good for them. Meanwhile, we have Suella Braverman over there in the United States, coming out really with her manifesto, with her agenda. When the Tories get defeated, I'm standing for the leader to replace Rishi Sunak. Here we are. Here's my programme. And that clearly involves Britain breaking with the European Court of Human Rights. She's not going to succeed, clearly, in rewriting the UN Convention on Refugees. So her agenda is clearly breaking with the architecture, the international architecture that was built up in the wake of World War II. So the United Nations, and it's worthwhile pointing out that the European Court on Human Rights isn't an EU institution. This was an institution amongst whose, you know, leading lights, you know, the most enthusiastic advocate was none other than Winston Churchill. You know, even when Britain made it clear that it wasn't going to be part of some United States of Europe, which he favoured, by the way, Britain still took the lead in the European Court of Human Rights. And of course, what Suella Braverman is proposing to do with refugees, and we are talking about refugees, is basically to tear that up, because she doesn't want Britain to be found guilty by that court. So the Tories are split on that. So you've got those that are committed to the post-World War II settlement. After all, if you take, I think the only countries in Europe that aren't signed up to the European Court of Human Rights, I think the only two is Russia and Belarus. So Britain puts itself in the company of those two regimes. Fair enough. And then they go around lecturing the rest of the world about the virtues of, law-based civilization, and how Britain is a fine and upstanding democracy. Yeah, that deports people to Rwanda, that confines people to barges. Yeah, sure. Okay, so John Curtis tells us that the key issues that concern the British population at the moment, I well understand why, are the National Health Service, which is creaking, not because, by the way, we've had doctors' strikes, that clearly adds to it, but the Tories have run down the NHS. That's been the actuality of it. But if you look at the bigger picture, what you see is, in spite of the rhetoric of the last Labour government, that's the Blair Brown government, what you actually see is waiting lists in the National Health Service fall, 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 because they threw money at the National Health Service. Some of the money they threw was crazy, i.e., PFI, Private Finance Initiative, which is just, throwing money at big business. Nonetheless, they got hospitals built, and workers got pay rises. The National Health Service expanded. It's true that Blair instituted just in time, crazy idea when it comes to hospitals. Either way, what you then see in terms of the graph is, under the Tories, it goes up and up and up. The pandemic is partially an explanation. That's certainly true. But the reality is that what we have is an older population. That should be something to celebrate. And what happens, of course, with us older folk is that towards the end of our lives, we tend to need the National Health Service in a way that when we're young and fit, we didn't tend to. So an aging population, but also COVID-19 plus austerity, has seen waiting lists climb before there was any strike to 6 million patients. It's now up to 7 million, which is just an enormous backlog. And of course, what the Tories are proposing is privatisation, privatisation, privatisation. Something one should note, Wes Streeting and the Labour Party are also playing with. In other words, what we've seen is the slow, remorseless death of the National Health Service as a public service. It's still just about, run on the basis of need, except we get stories, every other day of someone going to accident and emergency and waiting 24 hours on a, and we're not talking about on a bed, we're talking about on a very uncomfortable seat before a doctor sees you. And quite frankly, I know if anyone in my household gets ill and they say, I need to go to the hospital, I go, well, we will be waiting 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours before anyone even sees you or me. And that's enough to put anyone off. So the fact that you have these huge waiting times, in spite of the fact we all know that there's huge waiting times, that is eloquent testimony to how far the NHS has been run down. Anyway, my point is that John Curtis says this is the number one issue. The number two issue is it's the economy, stupid. And what we have is promises that inflation will go down. Well, it is going down. Well, anyone could have told you it was going to go down. Britain now apparently is growing faster than Germany and France. I don't know, and who else. But that just shows you how stagnant the G7 is. It's got nothing to do with British dynamism. It's the fact that all the leading capitalist economies are basically flatlining. Growth is there, it's just about detectable. And so you get the story, is Britain in recession this quarter or is it growing? And the statisticians really have to get, the fine tuning out before they can make a judgment. Meanwhile, of course, what we get is the government fighting culture wars, hence Sue Braverman and refugees. And the idea, by the way, that Rishi Sunak, with his five pledges, this is what I will solve, which included people coming over in small boats. The idea that was, no, of course, I don't know how many we had yesterday, but it was very large numbers. And I think this year we've had 20,000 people come over in small boats. Well, what a surprise, because you block people coming via the channel, you block people, you know, in terms of the Channel Tunnel, you block people coming on lorries. Well, of course, they're going to be coming on small boats. Well, they'll come any way they can. So we still get stories from certain parts of the world of, you know, people, you know, putting themselves in the undercarriage of aircraft. People are desperate. And so people, of course, will find a way into a country where they believe has got some sort of future, as opposed to the country they're coming from, where they believe they've got no future in it, either because of economics or because of war or persecution, whatever it is. Young people with dynamism will get to where they want. And if they, you know, are confined to a barge, well, you know, you escape from the barge, you go into the black economy. Of course you do. So no, that ain't going to work. Okay, finally, and I get to my, I will deal with the Trump link. Labour Party conference is going to be later this month. That's in Liverpool from the 8th to the 11th. I think unlike previous conferences, we know the result. This is going to be a rally. You know, all the votes I would have thought have been fixed up between the Labour leadership and the trade union bureaucracy. I could be wrong. Either way, as Harold Wilson famously turned around and said to the Labour Party conference, I know because I watched it on telly, I don't care what you vote. I care at what voters want, and I'm going to ignore you. Boo, boo, boo. And of course, that got him brownie points from the media. And so if by chance the managers haven't sorted it out for Liverpool, for Sir Keir, you know, he'll be pre-primed to show that he's above democracy, that he's got contempt for conference votes. And of course, under those circumstances, and this is the latest speculation, is that the Sun, the Times, the Sunday Times, they will actually come out and say that that shows you that we can trust Sir Keir. So there is a new biography of Rupert Murdoch out by one Michael Wolfe, and I think this is coming out that coincides with Rupert stepping down from being in charge of Fox Corporation and News Corporation. It's only meant to be, by the way, you know, in terms of the title his son is taking. I've never watched Succession, by the way, but I'm sure you'll get some hints from that TV series. But the idea is he's stepping down, his son steps up, but he's still going to be in charge. He's very old, though. He can only last so long. Either way, we saw it before. In 1997, The Sun, I think, came out with a headline. It was us what won it, or something along those lines. The Sun threw its weight behind Tony Blair. And this was after, I think, Tony Blair went to meet the great man and basically do a, you know, kowtow. I don't know whether Sir Keir has done that. I very much suspect he has. Either way, Michael Wolfe is precisely speculating about the Murdoch media in Britain throwing its weight behind Sir Keir. Now, in part, that can be because the Tories are so damn popular, even amongst Sun readers, the idea of backing Rishi is not a paper seller. Backing someone who's high up in the opinion polls, that can be a commercial decision, but it's also a how should I put it, a political decision. Murdoch is a very political proprietor. He thinks strategically in terms of where capitalism is going. So it's worthwhile noting, I can't comment further on this, that the New York Post, my understanding of it is that that is a Murdoch title in the United States, that came out and backed Suella Braverman in her Washington speech. So you can have the Murdoch press potentially, and it is only potentially, backing Sir Keir in Britain for their own reasons, but at the same time backing Braverman to replace Rishi Sunak after what most people are now, on balance, and no one's coming out totally. I'm not going down to the betting office. I'm not don't actually go to the betting office, but either way, the point would be that that says something about the agenda of the Murdoch empire and what's going on in politics, i.e., politics overall continue to move to the right. That's the line of direction. I won't comment on the Murdoch press and media on Trump. I'm going to leave that one aside. I simply raise the Murdoch media in Britain because it looks increasingly likely that we'll have Sir Keir in number 10. Hence, at last, I get back to my Donald Trump line of thought. The question that was put to him by Nick Robinson, I don't know if anyone listens to his program on Radio 4. I do rarely, and I didn't listen to this one. Either way, he was interviewing Sir Keir and he asked him the question, what are you going to do if Donald Trump wins in the United States? And Sir Keir replied, well, a Labour government will have to make it work. And I think that does tell you what. And I'm also informed, of course, by journalists, mainstream journalists, I've got no one on the inside, that in the talks between Macron in France and Sir Keir, remember we had that Sir Keir on the world stage meeting Trudeau and also Macron. And note that's a big, that's a significant thing for prime ministers and presidents to meet a challenger to your sitting prime minister in Britain. Amongst the subjects that they spoke about, of course, was Donald Trump and the possibility of a Donald Trump presidency too. Okay, so with that, I have finished, Anne. Thank you.